this week on What's Going On with Earl Ingram, joined by Sandy Williams, an expert in civil law studies, known for sharp insight and quick sense of humor. Together, they dive into the big questions shaping our world today, from whether artificial intelligence is helping or hurting society, to the growing divide between the rich and the poor, and why. Many believe it's time to start taxing the top 2% instead of the working majority. They'll also unpack the heated mayor's race in New York, where Cuomo and Mandani are battling it out in a contest that could signal the next wave of political change in America. Don't miss it. Airing on all platforms. Follow us at civicmedia.us or wherever you find your podcast. Please also like and subscribe so you don't miss the conversation. What's going on with Earl Ingram? I don't even know where to begin with my guest we're going to be interacting with for the next hour, other than to say he is a dear friend, one of the wisest men that I know. I've learned so much from his friendship and his knowledge that he brings to the program. He has worldly knowledge, but he also has a great sense of humor.
And, oh, shucks.
And I'm so I'm thrilled beyond words to welcome back my good friend Sandy Williams. Hey, Sandy, man, it is so good to have you back with
me
again. Well,
it's good to be back on. It's been a while. And I've been wondering for a long time, what is going on with Earl Ingram? But, you know, maybe we can get to the heart of it today.
Hey, can you leave the humor up to me?
Yeah, sure.
No. No, man. That's great, man. It is so good to have you on. And Sandy, not only is it good to have you back on, but the times that we are in are not a laughing matter. And, you know, you and I talked about the early stages before we got to where we are now. And I remember you constantly talking about what could possibly happen, where our nation could be headed. And you're always the eternal optimist. And it's been 9 months now, Sandy, and what are your thoughts?
Well, I've got a whole bunch of thoughts. One of them is I'm amazed at how adaptable human beings are and how we can get used to almost any condition that we're put in. You know, that the Gazans, I'm sure, they got used to being in a war zone that was horrible, and they somehow conditioned themselves to be used to it. I think Americans for a while here have become kind of used to having a process in place in which the incumbent wants to be an authoritarian figure, in which there's sort of a public wrecking ball being taken to the old norms. And I think some of it was because of the frustration of the general American people with the fact that not much was being accomplished on their watch, on their behalf. And so I think many people were willing to embark on an experiment or a different course, because, you know, the definition of craziness, do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. So I think maybe the American public said, okay, we're going to do something different, and we're going to hope that we get a different result. And you know, what's happening now is that the results they're getting are, yes, very different. And I think that this most recent election suggests that it's made many people uncomfortable with the nature of the current experiment. You know, that incumbents tend to suffer when the people are unhappy with their condition. And that's been an ongoing phenomena for the last 10 years. And I think that what happened now is that this experiment that people were willing to vote for has begun to feel a lot different once they're in it. And I think the experiment has gone way beyond the edges of what were perceived to be the edge of the envelope for the experiment.
Well, Sandy, it's just 5 years ago that the president that's presently in office today was the president. What experiment are you talking about? I mean, 5 years ago, we saw him. We knew exactly what.
Yeah, but I think the public understood that the first tenure of the incumbent was one in which there were brakes put on. There were kind of governors in place. Governors like you put on a motor so that it won't go too fast when your kid drives it. And those governors were people who constrained the nature of the impulse of the incumbent. And I think over the intervening 4 years, he became much more of a figurehead of anti-establishment. The extent to which the establishment tried to take him apart caused those who were looking for an anti-establishment figure to embrace him even more fully. And so, you know, some said, how could someone come out of the kind of fire that he was under? And, you know, he's a phoenix rising. Well, I think it was because he began to represent even more clearly an anti-establishment figure who was going to do things way differently. And I think a number of people with their frustrations and anger about their condition decided, yeah, let's go for that. Let's see how that works. But, you know, when you see it in place and when you begin to feel the impulse, and the impulses are different every day and things become erratic, things get done that were unthinkable, things happen overnight. You know, when you hand the keys to the ignition to someone who doesn't really have a driver's license, it can get bad.
You know, Sandy, what we're seeing is our government being dismantled. And I don't, not in my lifetime, Sandy, I don't ever recall watching this happen in my lifetime. I mean, you and I are not that far apart. Do you recall
not at all. I think most people have decided that they're going to run for office because they want to take government in a better direction, but it isn't that they want to essentially dismantle the government. But I do think that in this case, I've sort of been my edges have been smoothed on this. I think a lot of people wanted to have our government in the form it was in change dramatically. Does that mean dismantling? Well, I think an awful lot of people haven't had civics 206, you know, they've had civics 1 maybe, but not, they haven't really thought about it at length. Right. And I think a lot of people didn't understand why the checks and balances were in place, why it is that that our Constitution provided so much power to Congress and such limited power to the president. They hadn't lived under the monarch that the founders lived under and understood how it could be if somebody was given the keys to the ignition and given all kinds of discretion to drive as they saw fit. And so, you know, I think now what's happening is that we're getting a course in civics that's more like civics 500 because we're living it and we're feeling it. And a lot of people are living it and feeling it. And they're realizing that you give the power to too much power to one person, and it's not at all clear that they're going to be looking out for Tom, Dick, and Mary. The question is, who are they looking out for in their policies, and what do those policies accomplish on behalf of Tom, Dick, and Mary? And I think what's happened now is that this experiment has become uncomfortable, and I think that that's giving me hope. I think that our government is designed as it is for a reason, and now maybe we're beginning to be in the laboratory, and we're beginning to see what's happening.
So you think that the founders and the way they designed the government, clearly they foresaw threats like what we're dealing with right now, and it kind of put things in place, as you stated, where the president could only get 4 years and 8 years at the most. Yeah. Because they kind of realized and gave
the founders didn't realize that. That was the reaction to FDR in the 50s when they adopted the two-term limit. But I do think that the founders, the people today have become far less inclined to understand human nature and to take the view that human nature exists in all of us. And we all have both the positives that come with human nature as well as the negatives that are the result of the potential temptation and impulse. And so I think that the founders were cynics about human nature. They understood human being, and they understood human frailties as well as human positives. And so they wanted to make sure, because they knew that the monarch, who was just a human given too much power, had demonstrated the extent to which the frailties of human nature can be deployed by the monarch contrary to the interests of the people. So much of the Constitution was drawn because of an understanding that if you put too much power in the hands of a human being, the frailties of human nature could become very troublesome for the country.
Well, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go on. No, that's, yeah.
Well, you know, Sandy, Congress, the role that Congress is supposed to play to keep the balance, where it would not allow what we're dealing with now, but we're at a point where the Congress, as it's constituted under Michael Johnson and the Republicans, has basically just totally. Whatever you want, right?
I mean, some would say abdicated. Some would say they've taken a knee. Some more cynical people would say they've taken two knees. But, you know, the fact is that Congress, the House of Representatives, has decided that they, and I think this has to do with the human frailty of ambition. Congressmen have to run every 2 years. Congressmen are very worried about facing a primary in the gerrymandered districts in which many of them live, in which all they have to worry about is winning a primary, and they win the election. Primaries are easier to set up in a party, and it's been demonstrated by the incumbent the extent to which a movement can put at risk a person who's elected to an office in which there is no bipartisan contest. There's only a partisan contest. And so I think that ambition has played a role in an awful lot of these congressmen's decision to simply knuckle under and to not protect the powers of Congress in the face of this attempt to create what's, you know, the people who have sort of a intellectual philosophy about this call it the unitary executive. The unitary executive is basically the effort to create in the president more imperial powers so that the president can manage the country much more like a CEO who is delegated a great deal of responsibility by the board of directors that he or she reports to. And so this unitary president had become a philosophical pillar of the Republican conservative movement. And Donald Trump has taken the notion of a unitary president and has run with it to the extent that no one could have imagined. I think that the head of the OMB, Russell Vought, who's, I think, the brains behind much of the management of the business of government. I think that Peter Navarro, who's probably the brains behind much of the tariff policy, they have decided to persuade the incumbent to use the executive order at every turn. So almost everything that's been accomplished to date has been accomplished by executive order and not by an act of Congress. And no one in the House of Representatives has decided to stand up and say, wait a minute. These are powers inherent in Congress. And in order to keep this balance of power going, we in Congress have to assert our jurisdiction.
So, Sandy, in simplest terms, and this is why it's always been perplexing to me that, yes, the Congress people are afraid that they're going to run somebody against them and they're going to lose their seat. But the truth of the matter is, it's the people who elect them. It is not the power brokers and others. It's the average rank and file person who has to vote, Sandy. Shouldn't they be accountable to the people? More so than accountable.
Well, I think it depends on what the mood of the people is and the extent to which the people are alert And to, you know, what's happened was what I described earlier. I think an awful lot of people have been frustrated to the point of anger about the lack of activity on the part of government, that where that activity redounds to the to their benefit. And so it's, that can create complacency. Why should I vote? It doesn't matter. Or it could create an anger, like, let's change things dramatically to see if that change can, you know, what do we have to lose? We're not winning in today's world. Maybe we'll win in that, in tomorrow's world that's way different. And so I think that the mood of the public has everything to do with the extent to which they hold incumbents accountable, as well as the fact that when you gerrymander districts so that it's strictly a single party that's making the choice in that district, you then are susceptible to whatever the power structure is in the powder, whatever the ideological mood of the party is.
So, Sandy, if I'm looking at all the different power grabs that have occurred over the last 9 months, and since the Republicans are in charge and in total control, they have clearly, you know, pointed out that it's our way or the highway. And so they've done all these things. They don't ever think that the pendulum is going to swing back the other way, or are they just trying to live it all in this 4 years and get all that they can get now?
If when you know, when I read Project 2025 and when I watched what was ongoing, I think that a good deal of the instinct behind the movers and shakers who are behind, you know, the sort of intellectual powers that are behind these activities, they think that they are going to redesign the American government. And they think that this redesigned government with a unitary executive with far more power in the hands of an individual is the kind of government that gives their interests a much better chance. And the fact is, it's true. Those with financial wherewithal tend to be very powerful factors in authoritarian governments. The authoritarian government tends to cater to the interests of the rich and powerful and tends to begin to align state interests with corporate interests, with the interests of the rich and powerful, and to begin to exploit essentially the people as being the bargaining chips and the pawns without being the fundamental power structure.
So, but Sandy, Project 2025 and the people that you're talking about, these are pretty brilliant people. The American people can't begin to understand the magnitude of what is transpiring here because we're too busy trying to keep our heads above water. How do you see this ending?
Well, I think, you know, like I said, I think that when the American public sees and tastes the outcome, when they see masked ICE agents running around with masks arresting right. people, when that becomes a personal experience for many people, when we understand that boats are being blown up, you know, for a while it feels like a video game and it's kind of cool where this is rich and powerful America asserting its muscle. But after a while, I think people begin to think about the consequences and the notion that that's an ongoing process. I just think when people begin to feel the withdrawal of SNAP money and what is the implication of many people going hungry, when people begin to feel the premiums that are going to be paid for health insurance and what it's going to do to access to health care in the country, all these things become personal experiences that are much better than sort of classroom discussions and ideological, philosophical discussions about what might happen. And so you know, I think that the temper of the people is changing. I think that they're going to see these things and say, you know what, this, we might need a different path, but this is the wrong path.
You know, Sandy, it's almost a versus kind of situation. The ultra wealthy versus the American people, not Democrat or Republican, but the American people. At the root of this and the way things are going, Sandy, Isn't it kind of like that? We can't afford to be divided with Democrat, Republican in the end. This is a matter of survival of the American people.
Well, you know, when you go into a lifeboat, it doesn't matter what color the rest of the people on the lifeboat are, or what religion they are, or whatever. And so I think that to some extent, that this could be a unifying experience as more and more people of different, essentially all the different tribes in this country, begin to experience what they're experiencing. It might bring them together in a realization that they need to be, that we, as a unified, we need to be on a different path than this path that we're being led down under this experiment. You know, I think early in the administration, when the culture war was being carried out by attacks on Harvard University and places that were kind of theoretical to most people, and represented the establishment in a way that many people disliked the establishment, that sort of culture war was probably, in spite of the fact that I find it detestable, it was probably quite a successful venture on the part of the president and the incumbent to focus attention in that respect. But as they've moved on into actual areas of real public policy, and it's begun to have a real impact on many people, I think that even the attack on the universities is going to be looked at by the general public in a different way, as being unilateral conduct, vindictive conduct. You know, the constant discussion by the incumbent of a lack of knowledge of the pardoning of a kind of a clear white-collar criminal in the crypto area, the extent to which wealth is being amassed by those who are in close power or close to power, all of these things, I think, are going to begin to look and smell different when people have begun to personally realize the dangers that they experience, or at least the difficulties they experience.
So, Sandy, do you think that things are pointing in a direction? I hate to even say this, but for the last 3 years, we've been talking about recession, and you've been clearly on point with all of the conversations we've had as it related to that. But something is going to happen in this nation with the economy, and because it's recession has been held off in abeyance for so long, and stock market continues to skyrocket, are people somehow misreading what's going on? The stock market continues to climb, but people are struggling. The cost of everyday living is outlandish. So I guess what I'm asking you, Sandy, can the stock market be looked at as the economy? Because in some instances it is, but the majority of the people aren't in the stock market.
Well, you know, the stock market is looked at by, you know, and in the first administration of the incumbent, there was lots of talk about the stock market. There's less of it today because it's kind of leveled off in a way that maybe he doesn't want to point at. But, you know, I think that recessions tend to happen based on the truck that hits you that you didn't see. So most recessions in the last 40 or 50 years have been triggered by an unforeseen event, or an event that was foreseen by very few. So the financial disaster of 2007 wasn't really foreseen by many, but it was triggered by a particular kind of an event, the failure of these mortgage pooled securities. And so what we're ongoing now is a gradual process. Right now, the changes that are being made, each one of them have disruptive qualities associated with them, the tariffs, et cetera. And they have disruptive qualities, but they aren't the unforeseen event. They've been talked about a lot. They end up getting baked into financial decisions. And the United States still represents the go-to marketplace for money in the world. But many of the things that are being done now are eroding, number one, the value of the dollar, number two, the stability of the dollar. And so my fear is that, are we suddenly going to wake up tomorrow and have a recession? No. I think what's going to happen is that the United States is sliding based on all of these policies that are being pushed right now, the tariff policy, the purposeful pursuit of weakening the dollar, the withdrawal from the U.S., the U.S. withdrawal from world affairs as well as from commercial and mercantile affairs. In the long run, it's going to begin to dry up this appetite for investing in the United States investment instruments that the rest of the world has had. And when that happens, we're going to find a shrinking financial market. And what we're going to have is just a shrinking quality of life and a shrinking lifestyle. And it's much of what happened to England when England was no longer the world's reserve currency, the pound, and when England began to shrink from its dominance in the financial marketplace. And so, you know, I just think that hopefully Wall Street and others will wake up as well to the fact that what we're on now is a long-term road toward something much more like ruin than we are to something much more like make America great again. Well, I don't know if China's market will, but financial instruments need some place to go. Financial players need some place to put their money. One of the reasons so much money is kept in dollar instruments is that the dollar is the reserve currency that everyone's carrying out world transactions in. So even if you're an Indian company and you're trading with Argentina, those trades are most likely to occur in dollars. And so both the Argentinian businesses and the Indian businesses are maintaining dollar investments because they don't want to be bopping in and out of their own currency, buying dollars, selling dollars, because the volatility of their currency could make that a difficult transaction. So, yes, if the dollar no longer is the reserve currency in the world, it will have a major impact on the amount of demand there is for U.S. investment instruments, including stocks and including treasury instruments, which are the debt instruments of the United States. And if the demand for debt instruments goes down, that means the interest rate that will have to be paid on those instruments will go up, which is a very troublesome outcome. Well, no, actually, the rate of onshoring is the number of manufacturing jobs and whatever are not going up rapidly. So we can talk about corporations. You can find examples and anecdotes of onshoring. But the fact is that the numbers of jobs are the number of jobs and the growth in jobs is down, not up, the rate of growth.
You know, Sandy, it's confusing. And where we are now, I think, Sandy, is, you know, all this time we were told over the last 4 years that not to trust the government. Right. We were told that by the government that's in place now. Should we trust this government?
Well, I think that's what I'm saying. The experiment is being experienced by people. And now the question is, can we trust? And how do you trust someone, or how do you trust a government where whim seems to be the exercise of prudent thought? You know, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of careful thought. It seems to be whim that changes with the wind. You know, it looks like a leader that's got his finger up in the air. He's wetted his finger and he's got it up in the air feeling the wind rather than going through a deliberate process that is carefully leading us in the right direction. And so, you know, I've become more hopeful, actually. I think that the overreach of the wolves, there was an interesting David Brooks article this morning in which he was describing authoritarianism and as being essentially the instincts driven by wolves. And I think that our country had an instinct for a while where we wanted to be led by a wolf, thinking that wolf would be a shrewd one who would lead us in the right directions. And I think what's happening now is that people are beginning to feel, you know, there's that mayhem, that guy that does the insurance ads that you watch on when you're watching NFL games.
Yes.
And I think some are beginning to feel like mayhem is in charge in the White House, and that maybe that's a troublesome prospect. And the fact is that the MAGA movement is an individual movement. It is Donald Trump. It is not a Republican Party movement per se. And there are those who want to figure out how they can ascend to leadership of the MAGA movement in a PT period, a post-Trump period. But there are others who are looking at this and saying, maybe this is just part of an evolution, and it's going to move on to something that reacts to it rather than follows it. And I'm beginning to become more inclined to believe that it's going to be a reaction to it rather than an evolution from it that is going to be the follow-up act.
So Sandy, you read the entire Project 2025. We went over it over the airways with you and our listening audience. You've had some time now after having read it and now watching what is transpiring. Is it worse yet to come?
Well, it's following the script. It is definitely following the script, and the script is essentially a Christian nationalist, unitary-driven government, and that's clearly where Russell Vought is coming from. And then the question is whether the sort of this Christian nationalism movement, whether it has legs of its own, or whether it too will begin to react to the experience, the more general experience that's ongoing. And I think that the general experience is going to have a more overwhelming effect than the people in power have predicted. Yeah.
So I guess I want to, this issue right now with the government being shut down. Over the years, you and I have constantly talked about they're not going to shut down the government. I never forget when you, all over those years, we've talked about they're going to shut down the government, they're going to shut down the government. You would always say they're not going to shut down the government, they're not going to shut down the government. And Sandy, you were always right. They weren't going to shut down the government. Go ahead.
I think we might be conflating two things there. There have been shut down the government crises, and there's also been funding the debt crises, okay. Right? There's been funding. And I'm of a view that the funding issue is almost always they aren't going to do that kind of an outcome. Shutting down the government has less of the complete of the downsides associated with it. Although here we are in the shutdown, and the public is beginning to experience the disadvantages of the shutdown, and there clearly is going to be a political price to pay as the result of the process.
No, but a political price to pay by whom? Does it matter which side? I mean, people are hurting. They just want relief. And Sandy, this looks like it has all the signs of going on ad infinitum.
Well, I think the simple answer is that incumbents tend to get blamed for things that happen on their watch. You know, the inflation of the Biden period, the various things that happen, you blame the incumbent because who else do you blame, kind of thing. Now, you could try to create a theoretical argument that, no, it's the party out of power that caused this problem. But that's a more complicated discussion. I think the simplistic reaction in most people's brain is, I don't like what's happening right now, and who's in power? Who can I look at right now and blame for this? And so, you know, I think that's the greater tendency.
Well, so, you know, it's one thing to blame somebody, it's another thing to act on it. And do you see any political ramifications of this? If it, you know, I mean, it's already there, but if it continues,
well, I think the election results this week suggested that there wasn't a potential, that this was part of the reason for it. I mean, it was a very significant swing in votes in a number of states. They might have been blue states to start with, but they were much bluer to finish, and some of them weren't blue to start with and became bluer. So I think that there's growing evidence that that the experiment in place is an unpopular one, or an increasingly unpopular one. It might have prongs of popularity. Elements of it might be things that people would agree with, but the mechanisms in place, the way it's being experienced. You know, it's one thing to talk about immigrants getting and suppressing the level of immigration to this country. It's another to have masked agents running around in military vehicles making arrests of people that we know, and or we're fearing the arrests of people that we know. And so, you know, I just think that when the rubber hits the road, a lot of this stuff that was theoretical is much less pleasant.
You know, Sandy, when you're watching that and just manhandling people, right?
Yeah.
This is the United States of America, Sandy. You know, yeah, I mean, we're used to seeing this on television in other areas, but now they're comparing the United States of America to these other third world nations where this was commonplace.
And, you know, there's an instinct in people that think it's all right for somebody else to get manhandled, particularly if they think that they're doing something that's antisocial, or if they don't particularly like the people that are being manhandled. But I just think that that the American public didn't get all the way there, and I think the American public is far more decent than possibly the incumbents thought they would be about all this in terms of basic human decency. At least that's my hope, and that you know, that we're on the road. We're getting closer to choosing a better path.
So, Sandy.
And I'm not sure that path represents the path presented by the alternative party. You know, I think that the alternative party has to understand that people want a different path. They want it to look and be different. They want the outcomes to be different than what we've had in the past. But be careful.
So Sandy, the Supreme Court is right in the middle of a lot of things. It's going to come to a head, all the different cases dealing with what is taking place in this country right now. What are your thoughts about where you think, I guess, the Supreme Court's going to come down? Are they going to, in many instances, continue to side with what many of us know is just not right? Or do you think they're going to realize that we can't, our nation is in jeopardy and we must act? We're probably the last bastion of hope. And we've got to do something?
Well, you know, I think that most of the people on the Supreme Court, were particularly on the conservative side, got there because of they were rooted in the Federalist Society and the principles that the Federalist Society was interested in pursuing.
Which is what? Which is what?
Federalist Society is a group of lawyers that formed to basically counter what they've perceived as pervasive liberality amongst lawyers and judges.
Okay.
And so the Federalist Society started decades ago, and it was a group of conservative-oriented, ideologically conservative, conservatively-oriented lawyers intent on installing in judgeships a substantial number of people who were ideologically conservative. Then the question is, what does ideologically conservative mean? And some of the common threads of ideological conservancy and conservative views in the legal profession have revolved around what's called the administrative state. The question of whether what FDR created with the New Deal, which is lots of agencies in government who are delegated power by Congress to enact rules to implement standards for environmental pollution, for food and drugs, for all of the different agencies that were developed. And it was basically because Congress didn't know enough, couldn't write bills long enough to implement all of these kinds of regulatory things, and so they delegated power to agencies. And that the bureaucrats who carry out that delegated power became known as the deep state. They became known as a bunch of people who followed the letter of the law, yes, maybe, but they colored the letter of the law with their own liberal viewpoints, and they were implementing government in a manner that was exercising government control over all kinds of things. And so Neil Gorsuch in particular was one of the justices appointed who was self-declared as an opponent to the administrative state, wanting to get something that eliminated all the power of all these agencies to do what I just described. And that also melded well with this concept of a unitary executive. So you had a unitary executive who would run the country and run essentially roughshod over the bureaucrats and would exercise his view of the will of the people in the exercise of the government powers. And so I would say that to the extent, and then there were others in the conservative movement who were particularly hell-bent on upsetting Roe v. Wade. That became another strong prong. And so I would say that the people who were appointed to the Supreme Court, who were on a menu that was given to the president by the Federalist Society, basically had two things in mind. The destruction of the administrative state, the implementation of something more like a unitary executive, and getting rid of Roe v. Wade. And so far, these decisions that have been made by the court on the conservative side have been consistent with those intellectual ideas. Some of them, however, for instance, the ruling by the court on immunity, have been such that they probably underestimated this notion that human nature, given free rein, might become quite destructive. And so the immunity decision, I think, was something that if the Supreme Court had it to make over again, they might rethink it a bit. But now we've gotten to the point where the Supreme Court's going to be looking at some decisions that go well beyond how do you manage the bureaucrats into is the president allowed to simply initiate new policies and implement new taxes, so this tariff ruling. And I think that's why the justices in the argument this week were asking far more skeptical questions associated with the president's power to implement tariffs across the board at the scale that he's doing it.
You know, Sandy, as an average rank and file American, to hear the explanation that you just gave gives me pause, because we don't know as American citizens those kinds of things that are taking place on the periphery of our government to try to transform it and change it to benefit a handful of people and not the masses of the people. And so when you hear those things, you can't help but wonder. You know, we talk about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the flag, and all those things. And then there are these things going on inside of our government that the American people don't have any control over. That these people are controlling our lives. And so, you know, yes, for those attorneys and the people who understand all of those things, but for God's sake, Sandy, it's the people's lives, the average people who are pawns in this.
Well, the pawns kind of rolled over. You know, this frustration was, you know, some people said, why should I care? Why should I vote?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter. Or some said, you know, I'm going to vote the other side just because it hasn't helped me to vote this side so long. I'm going to vote the other side because it can't get worse. It might get better. And so I think there was an awful lot of that that's been going on for a while. And now the question is, what's the result of that kind of thinking? And, you know, one of the things that happened in this midterm election was the voter turnout was massively larger than had been in the past. And so maybe a bunch of those kinds of thoughts have been rethought, you know, like maybe it does make a difference. Maybe I need to be involved. And now the question is, who are the parties going to serve up as candidates? I just got involved just indirectly through sort of a social contact with a young man in Iowa who's going to run as an independent, I believe, in the first congressional district in Iowa, in the belief that an independent candidate can possibly win because both parties have moved out in the direction of such fringe policies that the public can't identify with it, doesn't agree with it, doesn't want it.
So Sandy, we hear and clearly about the Democratic Party, 28% of the people support the Democratic Party, and many of the people who certainly voted overwhelmingly for Republicans because, as you stated, they didn't like the direction of the Democratic Party. Well, you know, I'm sure they don't care too much for the direction of what they see in the Republican Party. You still think that there's a possibility that independents can gain ground now, if ever there was a time? Do you think now is the time that, you know, they can gain ground?
Well, I do think that what's happened to date has demonstrated that people want someone different. Mondami, this new mayor of New York, is obviously someone who is promising different kinds of things. You know, it's interesting because, you know, this notion of, like, taxing the rich, let's get after the billionaires. One of the things about America and Americans is that we're all quite aspirational, and hidden in each one of us,
we want to be a billionaire.
We might win the lottery, you know, and then we'll be a billionaire, and so more power to them. And so, you know, I'm not sure that being anti-something is what the people want. I think what the people want is an understanding of the policies that are going to fix their problems. Let's have a healthcare policy. I never thought that I would find myself agreeing with Marjorie Taylor Greene over anything. But, you know, out of her mouth recently comes things like, let's get some healthcare policy going. Let's actually think about it and do something about
it. Well, do you know why she's saying that, Sandy? To her credit, she's in her community listening to the people who put her in office.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because she's still a novice and hasn't been, you know, there in Congress for so very long that she is fighting for her constituents. You know, I mean, it is pretty amazing because it's not just in her area, Sandy, that people are struggling with health care. It's all over our nation. And it's nothing new.
I mean, healthcare is—it's not like it's a problem that's getting solved. I mean, there's little band-aids being put on it, negotiated deals with pharma to make this cheaper or make that cheaper. But at the same time, you know, the healthcare premiums being paid by those who have to buy their own health insurance is skyrocketing. And so, you know, clearly, if Congress was going to really try and fix some things for the American public, they'd look at healthcare, they'd look at child daycare, you know, they'd look at some of the things that would really matter to people and to us culturally. But that's not what has happened in the administration in which the keys to the ignition were handed to an individual. That individual has ignored all of the basic issues and has been fighting about and doing things about stuff that matter not to Tom, Dick, and Mary.
So Sandy, your perspective, which I always love hearing, where does this end? I mean, there's so, you're optimistic. What Mondani was able to do was get 65% of people who had never voted before to come out. 65%. Well, that was basically younger people, right?
Yeah.
Who had never voted before. There's still many people from your and my generation who still traditionally, you know, vote Democrat or Republican. But for heaven's sake, Sandy, did you ever believe that a 35-year-old Muslim could somehow become the mayor of New York City?
Well, now the question is, how manageable is New York City, and what can this person accomplish, or will there be a bunch of disappointed young people who think they are like? But, you know, I just think that that the more people get involved, the more educated they might be about what is possible and what is probable and what is the right direction. I mean, the fact is that there is no end game, because a government like ours is a work in process, and the work never ends, and the process never ends, and it bends, and it frays. I'll have to say that 9 or 10 months ago, I was worried that it wasn't just going to fray, it was going to break altogether. I'm more hopeful now in the thought process that that it's fraying, that the fraying is going to become obvious to more people. And that it might all work in the long run in the direction of an evolution towards something that's more effective, not less effective.
So about 3 weeks ago, a month ago, 3 weeks or so ago, I was the MC of the local No Kings rally.
Yeah.
And Sandy, 15,000 people. Well, people all over this nation coming together. We've seen that, Sandy, in, you know, I remember the Vietnam protests and civil rights protests.
Yeah.
And they had some impact, right? I mean, they really did kind of change some things in our government. Do you think we're at that point, at a precipice now, where people realize getting out in the street to voice our displeasure has some impact?
Yeah, I think I know a bunch of people who participated in the No Kings protest, many of whom had very positive things to say about you, Earl, and how you handled it. But I think in many respects, it's being done because it's an experience that they value for themselves. You know, people showed up in costumes, and it was kind of an event.
Right.
But that event has the tendency to spread. Other people hear about it. They understand that this isn't a radical kind of an activity. This is actually a mainstream kind of a reaction to a serious problem that people are perceiving, and people are drawing comfort from it. I heard from a number of people that they'd never felt more better about themselves and about the people around them than they did at these No Kings events. And so that's telling me that this is reaching people and causing people to behave in a manner that's positive, not negative. There was no violence in these events. These were all just very peaceful. It was much like the very peaceful civil rights activities that occurred when people decided, you know what, we need to be involved, we need to get something accomplished. And so does it happen immediately? No, but I think it creates a social movement that ultimately has a significant impact.
You know, Sandy, as I looked in that crowd and have watched them, the same kind of crowds all over this nation, they're people from your and my generation, Sandy.
Yeah.
Who really probably never thought they would ever be involved in those kinds of things ever again. But they felt compelled after all this time, Sandy, because they feel that their government is under assault.
Yeah. I think that people were, but it wasn't, the action wasn't angry as much as it was a desire.
No.
It was a desire to display unity on the concept that there was something more important at stake. And I think that was a very interesting social commentary that's going to have a significant impact and will spread through our society much better than anger. Because, you know, anger always requires counter-anger to have an argument. And if you aren't angry, if you're simply expressing this kind of important interest, I think it has a much broader impact.
So Sandy, here we are. We're into November. Everywhere we look, I mean, our military is just gone nuts. We've got a person running it that clearly should not be in that position, and he's unilaterally doing things, and we're making threats, Sandy, to nations. We're actually acting as if we're bullies Your thoughts on all of those things?
Well, banana boats, and you know, and sending Navy ships down to banana republics is an old tradition. Teddy Roosevelt and others participated in it, but certainly this whole Venezuela experiment. I mean, the fact is that the personalization of the international affairs of this country must be worrisome to a bunch of people. The notion that our policies toward Brazil would relate to how they treat a particular ex-president, or the personalities of the incumbents in places would become grounds for warfare. All of this, I think, is a demonstration to the people that if you give all this unilateral power to somebody, and they're not deliberate people but rather impulsive people, that the change you hope for is not necessarily the change you're going to get. So, you talked about AI in the past. What is AI going to do? You know, and I will tell you, I am not an AI avatar, but you know, next year, you might be interviewing an AI avatar.
I know.
And we'll see how those go.
It's not go. As a matter of fact, yeah. AI is, whether we want to accept it or not, it's here. It's the future. It's going to eliminate a lot of things. I was talking with a writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel last night, a good friend, and he does great award-winning, writing, but AI can do that for free.
Oh yeah, you can write a news article with AI by just plugging in about 10 bullet points, and you get about a 900-word article in seconds.
And Sandy, it doesn't cost for insurance or benefits or any of those things. And my buddy that I was talking to last night is a great award-winning writer, but I guarantee you AI could probably surpass him.
Well, I do think one thing that AI is going to do is going to cause people to understand the importance of having data and information behind decisions. One thing that AI is good at, although it's hard to corroborate whether it's altogether accurate, is assembling a whole bunch of information, going through the internet and finding all the facts that relate to what you're talking about, and coming back and presenting it to you in a somewhat cogent manner. And, will AI be the instrument of conspiracy theories? I'm sure it will. Will AI be misused? I'm sure it will. But it will, I think, begin to persuade people that huge amounts of data and information are important bases for making decisions, and that we shouldn't just do it based on our gut or our instinct. And currently, I think one of the troubles that the current administration has is they are clearly making lots of national decisions, very important to the American public, doing it on gut and instinct. And I think that's going to be a serious problem.
Well, gut and instinct is pretty foolhardy, right? It's always been foolhardy, but it's even worse today. With all the ability, Sandy, I use AI the other day. Cardi showed me for the first time. I got to tell you, man, I couldn't believe what happened. I could say a few words, and it could take something and create, and make me out of a genius.
Yeah. I mean, AI is, it's going to be, and in fact, I've got a grandson who's in the university studying AI applications.
Wow.
And the next generation of workers is going to be the successful ones. Are they going to be the ones who understand exactly how to use AI? They're not going to worry about AI supplanting their job. They're going to make AI and its applications fundamental to their job. And that is what's going to happen in the world. And so it's a bit like, the calculator that you can carry in your pocket that can carry out all the financial calculations that probably accountants and others used to spend days and get paid for days of work to work on. And so, it's going to be an efficient source of and a tool to be used by people. And then the question is it going to just open up a whole bunch of new paths for mankind that will mean that, yes, we're still going to have a bunch of jobs. It's just that everyone in those jobs better understand how to use AI.
So, Sandy, all these data centers that they're building all over the country, are those being built to accommodate what's going to happen with AI?
Yeah. The data centers, and it's unbelievable, the data centers now, the sort of standard size for the big ones is they use 200 megawatts of electricity. 200 megawatts of electricity could operate most of the city of Milwaukee
Right.
And they use tremendous amounts of electricity, and it's because AI uses computers to when you did that with AI and you got back this unbelievable kind of a thing, it went through a lot of iterations and investigated and asked a whole bunch of questions. And so, you know, how much does 10 seconds of massive data processing, how much electricity does that use?
Right.
Well, it uses quite a bit.
So we're not going to stop the future, right? And this is the future.
Yeah, the future is, you know, we've got a future politically, we've got a future sociologically, we've got one economically. And I think AI is going to play a big role in the future, in all of those futures. And I don't think it's necessarily frightening. I just think that it's like all massive technological changes. This one, I mean, all you have to do is use AI a little bit. Every kid who goes to school understands the potential for AI to write the essay that they would otherwise have to spend a lot of energy.
I'm sure educators can tell whether or not AI did it or whether you did it, right?
I know, but you know, this is probably going to be not necessarily good for mankind, but I'm not sure that wordsmithing requires a soul, you know, and so when we do it ourselves, we're applying our soul to the process of wordsmithing to create a message. And for lots of business and for lots of conveyances of information, the message is only just an adequate and readable summary of facts. And AI will be very good at that, probably better than you and I, because it will have more facts at the ready.
So as people push back on these data centers, they're going to go and find places that are going to accept it. They're not going to accept no for the data centers, right? They're just going to be everywhere.
Well, I think there'll be technological breakthroughs too. China figured out a way to do data processing with less electricity, to get AI outcomes. Also, how we produce the electricity is going to be changed. We probably will end up with modular nuclear fusion kinds of electric generators that might be the size of an automobile that would be able to produce enough electricity for a 200 megawatt. So you don't end up with the same kind of impacts as you do today. You know, to drive, there are 200 megawatt electric using data centers being built in Port Washington, being built around the state. Each one of them requires essentially a power plant, a dedicated power plant. A 200 megawatt power plant is not a small power plant.
Well, Sandy, we've got to wrap it up for now.
Yeah.
But it's really great to reconnect with you, and as we begin to rebuild our conversations, I'm thrilled beyond words, man. It's good to reconnect.
It is good to reconnect. You're going to the Bucks game tonight. Make them win, huh?
well, the only way we can win is if we start realizing that we got all these new young playmaking guards and we put the ball in their hands and not the 7-foot guy.
Right.
Yeah. Because,
but you know, they've other than this last game where they got blown out, they've kind of exceeded expectations, and maybe the expectations have to get adjusted, because I think they could have a really good team.
Yo, there's no question, man. I love their team. I love the changes that they've made. But we'll talk soon, my friend. Thank you.
Okay.